Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, along with Jason Henricks, and this week, we welcome back to the show frequent contributor Ron Shevlin to talk about his recent post in Forbes titled, "The Fad is Over for Bank Fintech Partnerships." Jason and I have spent a lot of time on bank fintech partnerships in our day job, so we're going to challenge him on that a little bit, but I think he makes a number of good points, as usual. Where we do agree is that for many banks and fintechs, it's kind of a princess bride problem. They keep using that word, partnerships, but we don't think they know what it really means. Then in the second half of the show, Jason sits down with Adwait Joshi, founder and CEO of DataSeers, a company that does partner with banks to help them drive value from siloed data. We'll talk about the challenges of extracting data from multiple silos and providers, and what banks can do besides just throwing money at the problem. And we'll also dive into a surprising and important problem that the company is using data to solve, human trafficking. Well, Ron Shevlin joins us now. Ron is the director of research at Cornerstone Advisors, a contributor to Forbes, and a regular contributor to Breaking Banks. Ron, you wrote last week in Forbes that the fad is over in bank fintech partnerships. What led you to write that?
Well, a couple of things, actually, but probably the straw that broke the camel's back was an article in the Knowledge at Wharton publication that was an article titled, "Why Partnerships Are the Future for Fintech." And in the article, the author wrote that as the industry grapples with what the next generation of bank and payment systems will look like, it's clear that partnerships are a linchpin for riding the wave of change successfully. And I looked at that and said, well, I'm not so sure that it's clear that partnerships are a linchpin for riding the wave. You know, I do a lot of work with a lot of mid-sized financial institutions in particular, and it's really become my sense that, you know, that partnering between banks and fintechs has become one of those management fads. And well, I think we'll get to this. I don't believe that it's a bad thing to do. What I'm really knocking is the idea that this is, you know, a given that banks and credit unions should be partnering with fintechs, when I think to a large extent the term partnership is being really overused or misused, I should say.
Well, building on that, Ron, I think one of the challenges I had in reading your article was partnership can be used in so many different ways that, and it's just bandied about without really defining, you know, what does that partnership mean? And I love how you got into the meat of it, you know, in describing, you know, platforms versus banking as a service. Maybe you could unpack that a little bit around, you know, what are the different definitions when we think of partnership?
Well, I think we agree on something, but maybe disagree on another. I think there's ways of collaborating and ways of interacting, but those aren't necessarily different ways of partnering. Partnering means something very specific. It means shared risk, shared reward, shared, you know, common goals and objectives. And I don't think that two parties going into some business arrangement, just because there's two parties in it, does not make it a partnership. You know, I think it's pretty funny where a lot of the legacy vendors in the space love to talk about their, quote, partners, where meantime, the financial institutions are sitting there steaming over the fact that, you know, they feel like they're being raked over the coals by a lot of these vendors. It's hardly anything but a partnership. But so I think we agree that there are different ways and the necessity for banks and credit unions to be working with in some form or another with fintech providers, whether they be legacy vendors or new startups, whatever they might be. But I don't think it's right to just slap the label partnership on every one of these things. And so I think what's kind of emerging are a couple of different, you know, models of collaboration, not models of partnership, but models of collaboration. And I think one for sure is, of course, you know, the term platforms has probably become another management fad or meme that's out there. But, you know, and that's another really misused term, because how many vendors have you heard say that they have a platform where, you know, I'm really thinking of platform more as a business model than a technology construct. So a platform like an Amazon, which of course is a huge platform and serves, you know, consumers and merchants. You know, in the financial services space, there are platforms like Kabbage, platform like LendKey that aren't consumer, you know, well, I guess they're consumer facing, but where the providers aren't merchants, the providers are financial institutions. That's not a partnership that a bank has with a LendKey or a Kabbage necessarily. It's more of a distribution channel and an opportunity to get processing services. You know, I think there are ways of connecting that don't even require a contractual arrangement through open banking and APIs. And then I also think that what's kind of emerging is, I guess I'll use another term that's become kind of popular, and I'll use it in a very explicit or specific context, and that's banking as a service. And what I was, how I'm thinking of that is where, you know, companies like a Harvest or a StreetShares that provide a very specific service. In Harvest's case, it's wealth management, and StreetShares, it's lending. And that's not, I guess, you know, that's probably more of a partnership, but it's almost a vendor relationship where the fintech is coming in, since we're going to, you know, run this product for you, and we need you to do some marketing and do some integration on the back end. But, you know, we're going to go out there with the product on your behalf. It's maybe think of it as white labeling a little bit, but where, you know, you're almost outsourcing the product. And then, of course, you guys, you know, running Alloy Labs, I think are very, very familiar with the with another form of collaboration, which are alliances and consortia, where, you know, financial institutions can pool their resources in order to take advantage of some of the opportunities to work with some of the emerging players out there. So, you know, I totally on board that there's this need for collaboration and interaction, but I'm really kind of railing against the slapping the label partnership along every one of these, and especially because as we enter into strategic planning season for a lot of financial institutions, I just see so many of them say, you know, for 2020, you know, one of our key strategic initiatives is going to be partnering with fintechs. Well, if you're going into it with that kind of mentality, you're going to be really disappointed when you find out you don't have the resources to get into a lot of these things, and that there's a lot of different alternatives out there that you haven't really thought of.
Clearly, part of the problem is this semantics issue. And you've talked about this for a long time. In fact, I often quote you that, you know, vendor managers don't write partnership agreements. They write vendor agreements. But if we set that aside, set the semantics aside of a strict definition of partnership is typically what's not happening. I think some of the issues that you cited still apply, regardless of what label you want to put around the collaboration. Like, for instance, you said that the vast majority of banks are not well suited for partnerships, and you cited three major reasons. The first, for larger banks, you say that their size and organizational complexity makes operationalizing and scaling partnerships difficult. Well, isn't that true of really any kind of collaboration? Don't the same kind of pains come into play?
Well, maybe, but I think in different scale. What, you know, it's interesting you pick up on the big banks first, because I was really kind of knocking the smaller banks for, you know, not having the resources to really identify and vet a lot of partnerships, where I think the larger institutions have the resources to do that. But what happens in the larger institutions is trying to roll out some sort of solution or scale some partnership. You know, it's a lot more than just, you know, integrating it into your mobile app. You know, as much as some of you at Breaking Banks and some of us at Breaking Banks like to think that branches are dead, branches aren't completely dead yet, and we still got to roll things out to branches and call centers and get people trained on new products and services and all those types of things. And so I think that becomes really difficult for the larger institutions to do on a large scale, because I'm not even sure they're thinking about it in those terms. But in terms of, you know, really kind of operationalizing this, I think it becomes a challenge for the larger institutions. I think it's a little easier for the smaller institutions, because you're just dealing on it with a smaller scale and a simpler organizational structure. Forget about the cultural aspects. We'll get into that in a minute or two. But simply the organizational structure in the mid-sized organizations tend to allow for better coordination, integration across lines of business than some of the mega banks do.
Yeah, I mean, certainly agree on all of those points. And I am with you. I don't think the branch is dead today. I don't think it's dead any time in the future that I can foresee. I mean, when we talk about the strict definition of some of these terms, I don't want to veer us too far off into the weeds, but this reminds me of a conversation I had just earlier today around this horrible buzzword of omnichannel that, you know, the consultants and the banks sure seem to like a lot. And I've yet to run into a single customer that says they want something omnichannel. And where the nugget of truth in there is that, yes, I should be able to use whatever channel I want to use at whatever time it's convenient for me and have a similar, if not exactly consistent experience. But that has got blown up to, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, and I'm sure you have too, this notion of, oh, I want to be able to start it on my desktop and then finish on my phone and then go look at my laptop. Who really wants to do that? Right? Nobody
Jason,
really
Jason does. Jason
well,
does.
Well, Jason probably does because he likes playing with the toys. But to bring all that back, though, we start with the bigger institutions, and then you noted both now and in your conversation or in your article, rather, in Forbes, that exactly as you said, smaller institutions don't have the resources. I mean, isn't that kind of an argument for more collaboration, though, and more partnerships since they don't have everything in-house?
Yes, to a certain extent it does. But the lesson to be learned is that you have to have, if you're going to do that, you need to build a capability, a competency around partnering. It's not enough to just take JD and Joe out of IT and go, all right, you're our partnership guys now. Go find us some partnerships. It's an organizational competency, just like marketing or vendor management in IT is. And so that's what I'm kind of railing against, is that too many institutions just seem to think, you know, oh yeah, we're going to go find some partnerships because it's the cool thing to do, because everybody on Financial Brand and Forbes is telling everybody partnerships, and Knowledge at Wharton is telling everybody that partnerships are the future of fintech. If that's going to be the case, you need to have a capability, and you got to have some good strategic direction, which is another thing that's missing in a lot of these institutions. But yeah, so that's what I'm kind of railing against, is not the idea that partnerships are dead, but that partnerships as the future of fintech, as a meme, as a fad, is kind of going away by the wayside. And, you know, let's look back over the past 30 years. We've seen a lot of management memes or fads come and go. I'm old enough to remember re-engineering as a fad, and then knowledge management as a fad, and dot-coms as a fad. And none of them go away necessarily as a legitimate idea and approach to management, but they go away as the fad of the moment. And I think that's what I was kind of writing, is that we're at the point where partnering as the future of fintech, as the fill-in-the-blank strategy for next year, is going away. We're still going to see partnerships. We're still going to see those, but it isn't going to be the strategy du jour that the consultants want to make it out to be.
Well, I want to push on that piece of it, because I don't even think partnerships is really a strategy. I think partnerships are a tactic that allow you to execute a different part. Unless you're like of the banks that have really built that up as a competency, where they're providing the back-end bank to these fintechs, where I would even argue that is not a partnership. That is actually a vendor relationship where the bank is the vendor to the startup, but it's not a strategy just to say, oh, we're going to do partnerships. You know, what kind of partnerships, towards what end? And, you know, by the same token, it's not just saying partnerships can't be the way you're going to go execute it, that there's a whole bunch of things that sit below that. And it's just very easy to throw out partnerships, just like we used to say relationships, that what's your competitive advantage as a community bank? My relationship with my customers.
The strategy is we're going to provide omnichannel services to millennials.
Right. Jason, you and I are in complete agreement, but I think that there's a lot of institutions that are trying to look for the shortcuts and simply say, oh, yeah, our strategy for fintech is going to be partnerships. Well, okay, but you're going to need a capability and competency around doing that. And a capability, not just in terms of identifying and vetting, but a capability around scaling and operationalizing these things. So, I think they're trying to get the shortcut to these things because it's the fad of the moment to say that partnerships are the future. So I think we're in agreement on this.
I think, you know, if you're just coming to this idea that partnerships are the wave of the future, you know, that wave has already crashed on your head and you need to be figuring out, you know, where you're going next. Because when we hear from banks all the time that their new strategy is they're going to be the bank for fintechs, and they act shocked when we're like, well, you know, a bunch of other banks are already doing that, right? That if that's your differentiation, you know, you need to figure out something because you're no longer the first to do it. So how are you going to do it differently?
Yeah, you guys got to go back and remember, JP asked the right question to start with, which was, what was my motivation for writing this? And my motivation for writing this was as much about to counter the argument from the academics sitting in their ivory towers, looking out against the world saying, ooh, partnerships are going to be big, and my wanting to disprove that. So, you know, that's kind of what part of my motivation for writing this was to disprove the conventional wisdom that this is the answer or the necessarily the future of where fintech is going. And that's part of it too. So I'm not necessarily saying that partnerships are bad. I'm trying to say is that there's different models and ways of collaborating and interactions. It's specifically, you know, as you mentioned, things like platforms and open banking and banking as a service and so forth.
Well, you know, I'm trying to go from good to great, but I'm still searching for excellence. So I don't know what buzzwords I'm going to put on my 2020 plan here.
Have you thought about more of a blue ocean strategy, JP?
That's actually one of my favorites. And as you know, a lot of our banks that we work with really do enjoy that because, frankly, so many of them are swimming so much in that red ocean where they're providing the exact same products and services to the exact same customer bases. And I think another angle on this is, again, relating to a conversation I just had this morning, is the very, very blunt instruments that we tend to use, right? We use, I already joked at one, millennials, right? All 77 million people born in a certain 18-year period must all want A and must all hate B and all those sorts of things. But we use other blunt instruments like income level or asset level or, hey, small businesses or whatever. And so part of this is really getting a lot better at really understanding who we're even trying to provide the service for. And for whatever reason, that just never seems to make the buzzword list. I hope it does, because then maybe we'll stumble onto some actual good solutions along the way.
I think you're spot on, JP, with the unpacking viewpoint. And that's, I think, maybe to extent what I was trying to do in the article was unpack partnerships into these, you know, different ways and models so that we're not just using this a single term to cover the waterfront.
Yeah. Well, you talked about them already, but let's go a little bit deeper. And you talk about platforms. We've talked about open banking a lot on the show. I mean, what's your current view as we sit here wrapping up 2019, looking into 2020?
Yeah, well, I'll throw my thoughts on the open banking is that, once again, we're dealing with a term that's just not very well-defined or understood.
Right.
And, you know, very different in from a UK perspective or European perspective than US, where, you know, clearly Europeans are much further along with their model of open banking than what it means in the U.S. But I think of it, you know, in terms of sort of an ability to interconnect without necessarily having contractual arrangements, you know, through data standards. And I think to a certain extent, we're pretty far off in the U.S. from having the common data standards to enable that sort of open banking model. I also think that there's a lot of institutions that, you know, use it as a buzzword to make it look like, you know, they're staying on top of things, where reality is it's a more of a threat to their business model than it is an enabler. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. I don't think we're anywhere close in the U.S. to really having an open banking model or solution just yet. Jason, you disagree on that?
I think it is closer than a lot of the banks in the U.S. would like to think. And it's not because our regulators are suddenly going to wake up and say, let's do PSD2 for the U.S. What they're going to find is some of their biggest competitors that have already started doing this in the EU have taken the medicine and are exploring these new opportunities are the ones who are going to come and say, hey, you know, there is innovation at the experience level, there's innovation at the tactical level, but there's also, and more importantly, innovation at the business model level, right? That true strategy innovation. And open banking has forced me into that territory. And now I'm actually figuring out what to do with it. And so while you end up with a whole bunch of domestic banks saying partnerships, which really means prettier UI or the fintech is providing the service and I'm the bank behind it, they're going to get clipped from the side by these, you know, innovations that are much deeper in the stack that they just don't even see coming and probably are truly powered by partnerships. You've never just said okay back to me, Ron.
That's your shortest answer ever.
Either I didn't make sense at all, or I finally completely run a circle around Ron Shevlin, in which case, you know, mark this as the momentous occasion. I'm dropping my mic and moving on. But do you agree that, you know, kind of being forced into it by regulation is going to force a different kind of innovation there?
I think in the U.S., being forced into this from a regulatory perspective is going to be disaster, because I don't think the regulators have a clue for how difficult it is to manage and utilize the data that we're talking about that has to enable this sort of thing.
But that's nowhere on the horizon, right?
I don't think it is, but I mean, who knows what you know, will happen in a couple, in even 2 years with potential administrative changes. You know,
well, what I'm arguing is I don't think it's regulators. I think it's the fact that it's already happening in the EU, and you're seeing banks that were forced into it by regulation there. They now have an environmental pressure that they're starting to innovate and Darwinistically evolve, that's what's going to bring it to the US. And that if you're in the US saying, well, our regulators aren't going to roll it out, Ron Shevlin says they're not going to roll it out, you're going to be surprised that market forces will actually bring it here. Happening in the EU, and you're seeing banks that were forced into it by regulation there, they now have an environmental pressure that they're starting to innovate and Darwinistically evolve, that's what's going to bring it to the US. And that if you're in the US saying, well, our regulators aren't going to roll it out, Ron Shevlin says they're not going to roll it out, you're going to be surprised that market forces will actually bring it here.
Well, okay, market forces like who? The big tech, the Amazons and Googles and Apples of the world?
Or, you know, is it going to be the Barclays, the BBVAs, the Chases of the world? What Citi's doing with their hub in London around, hey, we were forced into open banking in the EU. We're now evolving under a different set of competitive pressures because the regulators made us go there. When we actually stumble upon things that are new and interesting, they're not going to say, oh, we're only going to do that in the EU. They're going to start changing the rules of the game in how it's deployed in the United States. And I would say, you know, there's a twin pressure going on right now from Asia where it is the big tech companies and it really is around payments innovation, but they're not stopping there. You know, they're coming to the US as well.
Yeah, I would agree with you more if you had stuck with some of the big tech. I think that, you know, what, you know, a player like an Amazon or an Apple could do in terms of, you know, forcing more, you know, mashups from a product service delivery perspective, you know, and creating demand for that. I mean, look at what Apple has done in terms of creating demand for credit cards. I think it was actually Marcus or maybe Goldman Sachs CMO said that the most successful launch of a credit card in history was, you know, Apple. Imagine how embarrassing that is to financial services firms that the most successful launch of a financial services product was not a financial services company. But, you know, their ability to kind of think out of the box from a product service delivery perspective, I think could be much more of a catalyst to open banking than either the regulatory or any of the big banks. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for what JP Morgan Chase does, but I still think that they're, you know, looking at this from the perspective of what drives JP Morgan Chase's bottom line and not necessarily from a, you know, how can we, you know, create an open banking environment.
Well, you also talked about alliances and consortia, and you already called out, as you know, Jason and I are co-founders of the Alloy Labs Alliance. We've got nearly 40 banks now agreeing to work together, totaling $125 billion plus in assets. So we'd be a top 25 bank in the U.S. if it was a single institution. It certainly has its share of headaches working with multiple organizations at once. But at the same time, we see a tremendous amount of value and promise in sharing the cost, sharing the risk, and maybe just as importantly, sharing the learnings of working together. As from your perspective, Ron, what do you think the future holds for alliances and consortia of financial institutions?
Well, first, I think that to a certain extent, and boy, you guys aren't going to like this one, I think to a certain extent, alliances and consortia are short-term solutions or approaches for a lot of institutions. Helps them get into something, helps them jumpstart, but at some point, a lot of these consortium and alliances tend to fray a little bit because at some point the alignment of goals and objectives tend to change over time. But I think it opens the door for new types of players who can create this as from a more of a business perspective. I mean, look at, you know, Clear Exchange as an example, who, you know, started as a consortium of the large banks in the payments area, certainly had more than its fair share of headaches and problems and getting anything done, but was acquired by Early Warning Services and became a, you know, a standalone service now called Zelle. Merchant Exchange that was started didn't have the success that Clear Exchange ended up having in terms of finding somebody else. But I think the opens the door for for-profit organizations to create this kind of service. And so when I think about that, I think about organizations like Constellation or Sherpa, both in the credit union space. There's a couple in the banking space as well, you know, who kind of create more of an innovation platform. And guys should check out, you know, what Jim Marus was writing on Financial Brand this week, around innovation platforms, you know, more from a business model construct than, say, a technology construct. So some interesting stuff there. And I think that the alliances and consortium give way to organizations that are, you know, set up less from an alliance perspective and more from a contractual vendor perspective.
I do agree that this idea that you can take a whole bunch of organizations that all have individual goals and you know, different market situations and kind of keep them lashed together for life is probably not really viable, but being able to come together around specific problems or opportunity, I think there's great opportunity around that and huge upside for the banks that are collaborating.
Well, I agree. You just asked me what I think the future of it is. So I think, you know, there's a good life there for, you know, a good couple of years for sure. I mean, from a planning perspective, I think it should be on the top of the list of what a lot of financial institutions should be looking at. But going into it with the realization that after 2 to 3 years, that's sort of the life cycle of it from at least their perspective. Now, maybe there's a new life cycle that can start up in 2 to 3 years that would, you know, extend the life cycle of the alliance or the consortium itself. But I think from the institution perspective, you know, kind of looking at this from a 2-year time frame going into it is the way to do it.
Well, and I would say the part I would extract is you can't keep executing the same underlying strategy that banks have done for, frankly, hundreds of years and just slap new fancy words on top of it, whether it's a new strategy or relationships or partnerships, that if you're only putting a thin veneer and not addressing fundamental issues and changes in the macro landscape, forget about life cycle. We're talking about a death cycle then that I don't know if it's 2 years, but certainly is not more than 10 that those shifts, you know, begin to wipe out a lot of institutions that have not been evolving.
You know, as we head into break here, Ron, I'll summarize by saying, be clear, you're not suggesting that banks and credit unions just do their own thing and ignore fintechs and technology providers. You're thinking about collaboration in much more broad terms rather than a narrow construct of just partnerships. And maybe in closing, give a couple of thoughts of what you think. As you said, we are in strategic planning session. What should financial institution leaders be thinking about as they're looking forward to 2020 and beyond?
I would say this. I think there's been a lot of focus in the past couple of years around the notion of customer experience. And I think that has come at the expense of looking at product and product design and product differentiation. And so I think the idea that, that a lot of financial institutions have to start moving to is to say, okay, you know, what are we really going to get from the next incremental improvement in customer experience versus finding new product and services to go to market to? And so as you look at the fintech world, is to say, how do we expand and grow the set of products and services we're offering instead of just, you know, more incremental improvement of the customer experiences? I like to say, you know, fixing, you know, bolting an escalator on top of a horse buggy, you know, might add some convenience, but do you really want to put your money on a horse buggy these days? And so I think that's, to a certain extent, is what's happening with the core products and services in banking. You know, checking account is a, everybody still has one, but do you really want to come out with the next generation of the best checking account? I think you got to start thinking about products and services in a broader perspective.
So, Ron, we're going to have to leave it there as we head into break. As always, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insights. And we'll be back with more Breaking Banks right after this.
Hey guys, it's Britt King from Breaking Banks here. I wanted to introduce you to one of our new sponsors. They're a company called the Online Trading Academy. Now, let's be honest, most people weren't taught investments in school. Not unless you went to college and did specifically a finance degree or completed one of the specialist investment courses. And so you're probably looking at the stock market, seeing it blow up and saying, if I'd only got in 10 years ago, if I'd only done this. Now, if you want to be involved in the trading space, investing online, running that yourself, you have to figure out, what are the mistakes that investors commonly make? How do I manage risk in my portfolio? How can I develop a second income, a wealth education plan for my family? That's the sort of framework that the Online Trading Academy will give you. Now, to kick this off, they offer special briefing sessions in person where you can do a free 3-hour introductory course to learn about these elements of trading and investing. You sign up for this three-hour introductory class at otatrade.com/fintech. So they have free classes in your area. All you need to do is go along and register at otatrade.com/fintech. You'll even receive their professional insiders kit just for attending the program. That's otatrade.com/fintech. This week's Breaking Banks podcast is brought to you by Privacy.com. Privacy.com lets you buy stuff online using a virtual credit card number instead of your real credit card. This protects your identity, protects you from fraud. Recently, I was able to use Privacy.com for an online purchase of some movie memorabilia from one of my favorite TV shows, Fringe. This was a site I really wasn't familiar with. I wasn't sure how they were going to handle my credit card information. I was a little bit uncertain, so I was able to use Privacy.com to complete my transaction and protect my information. You don't have to worry about canceling subscriptions or trials if you use one of these temporary credit card numbers. You can set spending limits for yourself for each of these card numbers you set up or collectively. You don't have to worry about your card information getting hacked. That's the real beauty of this. So head to privacy.com/fintech. That is privacy.com, privacy.com/fintech. And as a special treat for Breaking Banks listeners, new customers signing up today will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Yep, that's free money to use on any online purchase where you use privacy.com. So check it out, privacy.com/fintech, and sign up today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
So today on the second half, talking more about bank and fintech partnerships, specifically around some data and some of the more interesting and challenging problems to solve. Joined by Adway Joshi, CEO, founder, and chief seer of Data Seers, an analytics and data platform, which, you know, it's very popular on the show these days. But, you know, Adway, first, thanks for joining. What problem did Data Seers set out to solve?
So if you look at the whole payments industry, it has gotten so big, so quick, and it's so different. One payment vehicle is not the same as the other payment vehicle. It has created a 4V problem, the velocity, volume, and variety issue. And hence, there is a lack of veracity. You don't have one place you can go and look at data and trust it. So that problem is very prevalent in the industry and is being taken advantage of by the fraudsters. And the banks that are in this space cannot deal with it. So we actually said, okay, let's actually come up with something that solves this issue for them so that we can actually take the next level and catch these bad guys.
Focus almost exclusively on the bad guy side of things. Can you break down, I love the pillars you described of the problem. So how have you approached solving those?
Sure. So let's take a real world example. You know, we do a lot of work in the prepaid space, and the prepaid space has been exploding thanks to all the new banks and all these new products that are coming in that space. One of the problems that exists in there is we don't check for credit. We just validate somebody's information. In today's world where all of the information has been hacked, it's available for purchase in the dark web, it's very easy for me to get an account in somebody else's name and then use it for nefarious purposes. And so if you assume that, you're going to have external data points and data points that do not necessarily exist in that specific space you're looking at. So how we have done or what we have done different is we have partnered with external companies like LexisNexis, where I could go and make a call to them and I can augment my data source. So if I assume that my data is not clean and it's not complete, the two things I do have to do is I have to clean it and I have to complete it. And if you complete that, and if you have now data that can be acted on, you will see that you have much richer results, lesser noise, and much accurate, much more accuracy in catching these folks.
Now, are you actually holding that data and creating a giant data set that's appended with this completeness and clean, or is that being held at the financial institution?
No, so we have what we call a data vault, where all the data goes in. It goes through a very curated process of cleaning, homogenization, ingesting, and so on and so forth. Augmentation is a big piece. But once it's in, it's completely sitting on our device appliance, and it's constantly being used for different machine learning algorithms that are solving different types of problems.
So one of the things that caught my eye when we were going back and forth in preparation is you have stumbled on a problem, the magnitude of which I was not fully aware, and just how large and global the problem is around human trafficking. Tell us a little bit about how did you stumble into that as a problem area, and what have you learned?
Absolutely. So it started with truly a serendipitous thing that, you know, happened, where we were looking through data patterns and we realized that there was a specific pattern which related more to sex trafficking than human trafficking. And we explored that more and more and more and said, okay, what is this pattern? And we ended up catching a lot of people, or at least finding a lot of patterns, which you know, basically told us that this was a much bigger problem than what we thought. Now, it goes very close to human trafficking. If there is a commonality that I can define here, is that individuals are trafficked for the sake of money, which means if you actually chase the money trail, if you have an idea of how to trace that money and what other data points you can actually look to catch this problem, you may be able to identify people who are potentially being trafficked. And the other data points are potentially databases that people have, relationships between individuals. And LexisNexis does a great job in that space. They have databases of how John Doe is related to Jane Doe and what are the degrees of separation. Do they financially bank together, and so on and so forth. They also have a database of little children who are kidnapped. And it's a big program that they run. So we started exploring the opportunity of what are the chances that the kids that were kidnapped, which there was no ransom request for, were potentially kidnapped for human trafficking. And can we take that data and correlate it to the data that we have in this, in the financial services space, and find some commonality that, okay, this kid that was being kidnapped was actually related to this guy, and that guy actually exists on my platform and his patterns don't make sense. So when you connect all those dots, you actually come up with something pretty amazing and compelling that says this problem can be solved, even if it is at a smaller scale to start with, it can be solved with that data.
Yep. Order of magnitude, how big of a problem is this, you know, both in the United States and globally? Because it seems like this is naturally a global problem.
It's a huge problem. It's very prevalent in the Asian landscape. It's very, very prevalent in the Eastern European landscape. I mean, if you go to France and talk about this, it's just kind of very common over there. You know, people are brought over from the Russia side and they're sold for different reasons. And, you know, as sickening as it sounds, that's basically modern day slavery in a way. And even in the US, it is a big problem. I live in Atlanta, and every time you take the airport train, you will hear it at least one or two times that Atlanta Airport has been taking a very strict stance against human trafficking. They have cameras that identify facial recognition patterns. Delta Airlines has committed resources. So just the fact that these guys are spending so much money, it's a humongous, it's a multi-billion dollar problem every year that has to be solved.
Yeah, I noticed that actually popping up in a lot more airports when it, you know, has the calls to action, a little bit like the New York subway about see something, say something, but it's very specific to if you see a child or a woman who looks uncomfortable, it doesn't look like they belong, you know, really trying to go after that.
Absolutely.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say that, and that's so true, right? These people are exploiting the fact that data is fragmented, which means, yes, somebody may have your facial features, but you may not be able to link that to something else, and hence you're not going to catch me. And that's exactly what we are trying to solve, where we are saying, take that fragmented data, connect it all together, and look at the pattern. It's very evident.
So how have you partnered with banks and financial institutions going after this problem? Because it seems to me that a lot of banks forget about the global landscape of fragmented data. Even within a single institution, fragmentation is an issue.
It is. And we typically work with the tier two or the smaller sized banks. The banks that we typically focus on are less than, you know, $20 billion who play predominantly in the payment space because of a specific interchange rule that benefits them. They don't have the resources to try and solve this problem on their own or try to solve this problem internally. So obviously partnering with fintechs like us, where we are bringing the technology, we are bringing the expertise, and we are taking the data that you have, which is siloed, connecting all together to fight a problem. This is actually a true partnership, because what's starting to happen now is our banks are coming back and saying, hey, you work with bank A and bank B and bank C. Can we actually all partner together? Because this is a problem much bigger than any one of us. The only way you're going to be able to solve this is if we all partner, truly partner together. So it's a two-way street. Fortunately for us, it's not a one-way street. You know, we don't get treated as a vendor. We actually truly get treated as a partner. And how I distinguish that is I'm often involved in the strategy sessions at the bank. I'm very well connected with the senior management of those banks. And I'm constantly involved in, okay, what's coming in the next 2-3 years? And what should we be thinking about? How should we take that into our planning and so on and so forth?
So in the first segment, Ron Shevlin was putting out that, you know, while many banks, especially the banks of the size that you're talking about, partnership was just the fancy term applied to vendor management. And you're saying, you know, your involvement is deeper than that. What actually sets a bank up to be a good partner versus slapping the, you know, the new sexy label of, ooh, you know, we now partner. We don't have vendor relationships. We have partnerships. What makes a bank a good partner?
Absolutely. If you look at the segment that we work with, which generically can be categorized as community banks, the whole concept of a community bank has been on a partnership. You have never been just a customer of theirs. You know, the way these community banks work is they know you, they know your family, you know them, you know them, their family, and you know, these guys do stuff for their community in a much, much different way than a typical traditional bigger bank would do. And that's, I think, imbibed in their entire culture, at least the banks that we work with, which are smaller in size and very strong community banks. So when we go in, the only way for us to succeed is if we continue that culture and we end up partnering at that level with them. If we don't, then we will be treated as a vendor, of course, and it will be a lose-lose for everybody, because at the end of the day, this is a two, like I said, it's a two-way street. If I'm helping you, you got to tell me what the problems are. You got to work with me and explain to me the struggles that you're having so that we can actually address those and solve them. But if you don't tell me, and if I'm truly a vendor, like you bought a software and never spoke to me again, it's going to be very difficult for me to solve the specific problems. And those problems change over a period of time, right? It's not a constant problem. I mean, fraud has morphed so much over the past 20 years, even with over the past 5 years.
Yeah, so the bad guys are perpetually moving, right? You know, they're some of the most innovative out there.
Exactly. So if you see something, you say something precisely also works in the banking space. And that is what creates a true partnership where there is a constant dialogue back and forth. And it's not about just, you know, selling a software and getting a check back. It's more than that. You know, it's more constant talking to these guys, bringing them together, helping them understand the size of the problem and so on and so forth.
So how is it that the banks are able to articulate some of the problems and the challenges they're facing here? Because it seems like some of those are unknowns still in terms of, you know, what they're actually solving for. How do they normally express that? You know, because banks are very good at solving for known knowns, doing things scalably, reliably, and compliantly, but stepping into that kind of great unknown can be, you know, quite a challenge for them.
Absolutely. And this is a great question. I mean, nobody's baby is ugly. You ask somebody what your problems are, nobody's going to say, okay, here is a list of problems, right?
And let me share it with somebody outside my organization. I don't even share it with a lot of my executive team.
Absolutely. So it's a little bit of prying. It's a little bit of helping them understand, right? So what we do quite a bit is we actually proactively show things to them. Hey, these are the patterns that we are realizing and we are seeing. Maybe you have seen them, maybe you have not seen them. If you have seen them, help me understand. If you have not seen them, let's actually try to explore this further. So we take a lot of times, you know, a proactive approach, because let's just be honest, when I see something new, it's so new that nobody else has seen it. So it's my job as a company, as a technologist, and as a data science person to go back and tell people what it means. I mean, I'll give you a great story. Many years ago, I was working at an analytics company, and we had created these fancy dashboards and reports for a large retail giant. And we sent those, printed those out, and we gave them to an executive. And he pulled out a book that was at least 500 times bigger than that and said, these are the reports that I get every month. Do you really know what I know? I mean, I understand what's in them. And that like lit a bulb, saying that a lot of times when you show these dashboards and graphs and charts, the first question people ask you is, well, what is this really? Like, explain this to me. So what we have done is we have actually taken it down to a very specific problem. Okay, individual in this geography is doing this type of patterns, and this is what it really means. And when you explain that, then they're able to articulate it more as like, oh, that is a problem, and here is why, and blah, blah, blah. So what happens is you have to be very specific. You have to assume that they don't know about this new world of data science, because again, these are community banks. They have never been having a data-driven approach, and you have to instill the data-driven approach into them. So that's why it becomes a true partnership. It's never a vendor relationship for us.
So what capabilities does the bank need to be developing now, either technical or human, process, culture around this? How do we become more data driven?
Absolutely. So you'll hear one thing from credit unions and a lot of other banks that they have a lot of data. They just don't know what to do with it. And the reason is, you know, in fact, I'm just giving a presentation tomorrow, and one of my slides says you have a problem, which is, okay, we don't know what to do with the data, so how do we solve it? Most people just throw money at it, and billions of dollars are being thrown at it. What everybody is missing is, what is the question zero? What are we really trying to solve? What is this data, what it means, and what can be done with it? So, you know, before we start bringing the scientists on, we got to take a very simple step of, okay, just do some data discovery, do some data governance pieces. Garbage in, garbage out. But what if you actually had a process where it acted like a water filter, where no matter how bad the water was, as soon as it goes through that filter, it becomes palatable. The same theory applies for data. People who are sitting on that much data, they don't know what to do. Well, they can run it through our engine and it will correlate it. And it will tell them, okay, this is what's actually happening in your platform. And at that point, what happens is there's an aha moment. And then they start asking more questions. But they will never ask the question until you show them what the data is trying to say.
Yeah. you know, that really resonates with me. I like the analogy of the water filter. You know, it doesn't matter just how dark and cloudy that is. If you start filtering it, you know, you can continue to refine. But, you know, for a lot of these banks, they're using, you know, one of the big three cores where, you know, the data, again, is back to its in silos and also is not very easy to get out. How have you been able to solve that problem?
Absolutely. So, you know, let's take a very specific examples, right? So if a bank is on a core and they have a credit platform from another processor, and then they have a loan management system from another processor, right? So the good thing is we have partners. There are partners who actually have integrated to every single one of our cores. Our APIs and our data play is very simple. You drop the data in a demilitarized zone for us, we can take it up. If we have an API and you can push it to us, we can take it up. So we have made it very easy for them. Or we partner with other companies where you can actually connect to those things and bring it live. Now, banks are not used to working in a real-time environment, at least the banks that we work with, right? So they are more batch-oriented.
Yeah.
I mean, you get your salaries paid, you know, every 2 weeks. There is such a big industry right now that says get paid instantly, right? And the issue is that the operations on the backside of the banks are still batch. What we are doing is we are actually challenging some of that status quo, saying, are you willing to wait 2 days to catch that bad guy who has been on your platform for 2 days? Or do you want to catch him as soon as I find something's wrong? So how can we move towards more real-time data, more real-time feeds? So with our APIs and with the APIs that we connect to, the push and pull of the data becomes very easy. And the good thing is, because we are on the back side of everything, we don't affect any front end. So a customer never gets affected because we are putting too much load on the core, for example. Right? We are pulling it from the back side, which means I can still do what I can do 1 second after. That's what I call it. And the reason why I say 1 second after is because it's, you know, easier to explain. We really can get into sub-second response times. But that's what we do, is we pull through APIs, we push through APIs, flat files. It really doesn't matter to us what. As long as we can get access to that data, we will pull it in.
Now, what kind of variances are you seeing between EU, the advances in open banking, versus what's happening in Asia, where payments, you know, and embedded payments that are being led by the tech companies that are much more data and tech savvy? Talk a little bit about what you're seeing from a global perspective.
Absolutely. So I do work quite a bit in the Asian space as well as the European space. And one of the major things which is vastly different, right, between these geographies is the question of who owns the data. The whole thing about GDPR was the consumer owns the data. Whereas in the US, the way it works is if you give your data to somebody, aka Facebook, now Facebook owns that data. Right. And there is a lot of fight going on between all these, you know, with CCPA coming out and who knows where we will end up saying, okay, this data is it belongs to the consumer. And that's where the open banking is coming from, saying you're voluntarily sharing this information with all the banks for a single purpose, that the banks can make you better offers. But if you want to pull this data from that at any given point of time and you say, nope, you're not going to have access to it anymore, you can, right? So there is ideological differences between different countries, right? So each country has their own rule. India typically will not allow you to work with any data that leaves India. So if you're working with the banks there, if you're working with the payment corporations over in India, that data has to be physically sitting within the boundaries of India. Singapore has similar laws. But, you know, the Western world is a little bit more mature. They say that it doesn't matter where it physically sits as long as you can protect it with the same laws of that country.
That does, you know, make it difficult if you're going to be Google Cloud or Amazon Web Services and you have to show that that data is only sitting, you know, in a network operation center or a data center physically in country.
Yeah. And you bring up a very good point, right? I mean, most of the people that we work with are so scared of the cloud. I mean, and rightly so. Every day there is a new breach out there, right? And it's coming from either, like 2 days ago, there was an article, something happened on Google Cloud. Before that, you know, we had this whole thing that happened on AWS. Now, it's not that the cloud is bad or they don't have the security or you can't protect your data. It's people who are making those mistakes. So somehow, somewhere, there is this notion that if I can put it in my data center, then I can block everybody from coming in. So, you know, if you look at the Asian, especially India, they are still so much data center oriented. even on the core side, right, all the big cores, they have those mainframes sitting on-prem. So these banks actually love the fact that you're running something in a data center or running something in their environment.
Yeah, as if physically locking the door is going to keep the bad guys out.
Exactly.
I want to pull on this thread of data ownership a little bit more in the idea that, you know, I get that it, if I give Facebook data, I have an expectation I should be able to pull it, you know, back when I want. But when we get into these nefarious activities, right, when we talk about sex trafficking and things like that, do the same rules apply? You know, how are you seeing banks and, you know, by extension, what they have to justify to regulators? You know, how is that playing out?
Absolutely. The rules are very different by country, of course, but there is a very generic blanket statement over there saying that if you are in the financial space and if you are actually moving money, which means that you fall under this compliance umbrella, that if you came to me and told me that, okay, delete all of my information, I cannot. I have to keep it there for a certain amount of time. It could be 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, mainly because of compliance reasons. Because, you know, you can't just come onto a financial platform, commit money laundering, and then say, okay, delete all of my information and expect to, you know, get out scot free. It doesn't work that way. So, you know, the rules are still in favor of the regulators and the, on the compliance side. Anytime you bring compliance in, there is this big question around, okay, you know what, you can't just come to me. Even in GDPR, if you told me to delete the data, and if your account, if you have transacted on that platform, there is a certain amount of time that has to go by before that can take place, mainly because I don't know what I don't know at the time, and that has to be kept like that.
Got it. Interesting. And not thought about, you know, the data privacy actually, you know, can be a bit of a shield for the bad guys. Now, as we're wrapping up here, and it is such a large global problem, how have banks been working together to address this either with regulators or with other banks? What approaches have you seen, and what should we as an industry be doing to solve this?
Right. So the bigger banks, right, the large institutions who have the time and the resources and the money to do this have kind of started saying that, okay, what if we work with other companies? So, you know, large companies like LexisNexis have a fraud defense network. And the fraud defense network, which is very similar to what an insurance industry does today, in a way, if you try to buy insurance today, they will look you up in a common database. It's a contributory database that all of these insurance companies have shared because they have said that, okay, this guy is trying to defraud me, but I'm pretty sure he has done this to other people. So the same thing is now starting to happen. So you see a lot of these data sharing coalitions, and you see a lot of companies who are saying, okay, we need to share this data and create a contributory database. The problem is that although they're willing to do it, the problem is that they're scared, number one, about the security, and two, they may or may not have the technical resources to actually do something like that. And then add on top of that the data ownership issue, right? Who owns that data at the end of the day, right? If you create a fraud database, who is the ownership? So we are starting to do something very unique where on our platform, these banks, if they want, they can share the fraudulent database of individuals to be benefited for other banks. And the way the data ownership works in there, it's co-owned. It's basically a distributed ledger. It's a blockchain where you actually co-own the data. So there is not a single owner of that data because it's a contributory database. And that ownership of, you know, if you're participating, you share. So you don't have the concept of a leech, as you may in the traditional world. You're contributing something, which means that we co-own this database because at the end of the day, there is just one war. It's not a war between one bank versus the other bank. It's the war between the good and the evil, where all these banks still want to fight the same fraudster. And now coming together, they actually can.
Well, so last question. I promise that was the last. How does cryptocurrency play in? Like, doesn't it, you brought up the Bitcoin or blockchain, you know, doesn't Bitcoin or using another crypto allow these criminals the anonymity that they're looking for to circumvent the system?
So you bring up a good point, but, you know, it's not just the crypto, right? If you look at regulation in the US, I met a guy yesterday from and he's from Berlin, and he made a joke, and he's like, you think that banks in Germany care about money laundering? We don't. And if you look at the Swiss banks, they allow you the anonymity of moving money in and out, and some banks in the Cayman Islands who allow you the anonymity of money in and out. It's the same principle. Cryptos has been in the news quite a bit, but there are countries and there are banks who have been allowing people to move money in and out anonymously, and that data is never disclosed anywhere. So that is literally facilitating money laundering in a way. So although crypto was traditionally designed to not being able to ultimately track after a certain amount of time, I think the problem exists still a lot on fiat currencies than it exists on the cryptocurrencies. Because let's just be honest, how many countries have officially banned the use of cryptocurrencies today, right? India is one of them. You cannot buy or sell cryptocurrencies in India, which means if you want to do money laundering, you're actually going to do it in fiat. You're going to use cash or these other bank accounts in Swiss bank or somewhere else where nobody is going to keep track of anything.
Yeah, that is a very good point. That if you think of relative scope and scale, right, you're going to use fiat just because it is a lot easier, to do that. And, we had a guest on, I'm trying to think how long ago, he said, if you're going to commit fraud or do these nefarious things, nothing beats good old hard currency for its anonymity and ability to transfer and to circumvent these things.
Bingo. So I think we should be much more scared of these remittance companies that are popping up than we should be scared of cryptocurrencies. In my personal opinion, I'm not saying cryptos are safe or they have a good way of tracking and regulation. And that's what you're seeing today, right? People are trying to really figure out how to regulate it. Wasn't there a letter that went out to the CEO of Stripe a couple of days ago by the Senate saying that we don't know what's going on with Libra and, we want you to be careful, blah, blah, blah. So they're trying to figure it out. It's just as difficult. But I think the problem still exists in plain old fiat.
Yeah. Well, I know you have an interesting article coming out that really delves into the sex trafficking issue. If people want to learn more about DataSeers or to find, some of the work you've done in this space, where can they track you down?
So our website is www.dataseers.ai, and pretty much all of our social handles are DataSeers. Anything that comes out will always get published there first. So they can always do that. My Twitter handle is AAJoshi. You can follow me on Twitter as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time, especially thank you for helping the community banks in those attacks, such an important and global problem that we have in this space.
No problem. Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Special thanks to Ron Shevlin and Adwait Joshi for joining us today to talk about big banks, small banks, all trying and thinking about partnerships with fintechs. Hey, if you liked what you heard today, if you don't mind taking a moment and giving us a 5-star rating on wherever you get your podcasts, even better, if you know someone who'd like the show, give a recommendation. As always, we enjoy your feedback at BreakingBanks1 at Twitter or info@provoke.fm. That's all for this week's Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.